Super. Okay. So I suppose just two quick things that maybe Declan didn't mention specifically in terms of the law. Just one that I'll say is, I mean, you know, the vast majority of people when they kind of study the law, I studied law myself, so I'll give my introduction now in a minute, but the vast majority of people when they study the law, they kind of, you know, they start, they get through it, they finish, and they kind of say, okay, that was nice, and that was that. But I suppose there is maybe the 1 in 100 or 2 in 100 who kind of maybe start studying it and decide that they really, really, really love it. So if that is you, the vast majority of the information that you need in terms of certainly passing the exam and so on, well, not vast majority, all of the information you need to pass the exam and to go even further than that is contained in the notes, okay? But there is additional reading available if you do want it. So it's not mine, so I'm not plugging my book. So this is The Principles of Irish Law by Brian Doolan, okay? So if you do fall into the category of you start reading it and you decide you've got an absolute hunger for it, and you really, really want to kind of study more and more of it, and you want to maybe go for the, you know, right at the top of the class, you can certainly look at getting that, but you don't necessarily have to. Okay, that'd be the first thing I'd say. Second thing I'd say is, you know, law is tricky. Okay, there is probably nobody apart from the odd genius out there who gets it all in one go. So I certainly don't expect. I didn't get all of the stuff that I read through in one go. There's still bits and pieces in the law that I don't fully understand and I don't fully get either. So I would say read through it a second time. If you find yourself still stuck, reach out to me. Okay, that's what I'm there for. I can certainly talk you through it. Okay, and many other students have done in the past. Okay, and they're not. They're certainly not the people who at the end of the year ended up at the bottom of the class or anything like that, so there's no, don't feel any, you know, that's what we're here for. Okay, all right. So in terms of introduction, so my name's Paul Daly. Much to my father's disappointment, I'm not a barrister. I'm not a solicitor, and much to my wife's disappointment, I do not take home the wage of a judge every month either. So I'm none of those three professions, okay? I actually spent most of my life, similar to Declan, in credit management, but I've now gone off and gone into another direction. So why am I teaching the law? Many years ago, I did attend UCD, and I did the business and legal studies course back in the 90s. The stuff that you're going to be ingratiated with for the next kind of 10, 12 weeks or so, I studied it for 4 long years, okay, and felt every bump along the way, okay. But that said, you know, didn't love it enough to go into the legal profession. But that said, I certainly have a very good working knowledge of the stuff we're going to cover off. I did do this course myself many years ago. I started it in 2008, I think it was the springtime. So I did the certificate in the spring of 2008, and then I moved on to the diploma in the autumn of 2008 when all hell was breaking loose and I was emailing Declan saying, where are the notes? And I was getting replies back saying, I'm still writing them up because I have to change them based on what's going in the current events. So I did study that and then started doing corrections with Declan in kind of 2010, 2011 or so, and then gradually moved on to be a fully-fledged tutor. So that's just a little bit about me. So I was sitting there 10 years ago like yourselves. Okay. Okay, so Declan has told me to kind of keep it to kind of 40, 45 minutes or so. So normally I struggle to kind of squeeze it all into the hour. So we'll have to go at pace. So there's 5 topics we're going to cover off. Okay, law is extremely detailed and complicated. So there is no way we are going to cover anything in any massive depth in the hour. Okay, so the aim is not for you to kind of scribble everything down for the next hour and try to remember everything and say, oh my god, I missed that. So that's not the aim. The aim is just to give you a whistle-stop tour of what we're going to be covering off in the next kind of number of weeks, okay? And the hope would be that when you're reading stuff through in the weeks ahead, something may kind of click and say, oh, that's when Paul talked about that, that's when Paul talked about this. It's just to give you a flavour as to what's coming up in the next in the next number of weeks, okay? So by all means, take notes down as you wish, but there's certainly no pressure to kind of note everything down as you're going along. It will all be in the notes, and it'll be in the notes in more detail than I'm covering off now. Okay? So there's 5 things we're covering off. We're going to start with an introduction to Irish law. We're then going to move on to contract. Those two are both in the first modules that you're going to be getting next week. Okay? Then module 2, we move on to company law. Module 3 is primarily based on EU law. And then the final module is, which you'll be getting in a number of weeks' time, is the law of torts, okay, which basically is the law of accidents. Okay, very interesting area, and hopefully, time permitting, we'll get to cover it off a little bit towards the end. Okay. As Declan said, you do two assignments. One will be on the law of contract, which you'll be getting in a couple of weeks' time, and then towards the end of the course, you'll be getting your second assignment, which is on the law of torts, which, as I said, is to do with accidents, or the actual official definition of a tort is a wrong. Okay. And then throughout you'll be getting the four workbooks. You don't need to return the workbooks to me, they're just for as a guide to make sure if you can answer the questions as you're going along in the workbook, then all is well. If you're struggling with the questions as you're going along in the workbook, all is not well, and that's the time to kind of pick up to raise your hand and say, I needed a little bit of help. Okay. All right. So first topic that we're gonna cover off is just a general introduction to law. Okay. So there's five actual sources of law. Oops, that is the next module. There are five ways in which we get the law in this country. Okay, first one is common law, which is basically the judges. Okay, so the judge's job is to interpret the law, but it is also, to a certain extent, the judge's job to actually create the law. Okay, so the direction that the judges go decide what way the law is actually going to progress in this country. It's not the only way it's decided, but it is one of the ways in which we decide in which way the law is going to progress. Okay, so going back many, many hundreds of years ago, prior to the Anglo-Normans arriving in 1171, the way that law was dispensed in Ireland was basically, if you can imagine it, it was basically like a travelling circus that kind of went around the kind of country of kind of wise men who would decide on any disputes or any decisions that needed to be made. Mainly, I suppose, given the times that they were in, dispensing justice, people who committed what was deemed to be criminal offences way back then, they would be dispensing justice that way. That was the way the courts operated until the Anglo-Normans arrived in 1171, okay? For the next 600, 700 years, the laws were still actually done in Ireland, but then in the year 1800, with the Act of the Union, all laws began to come from Westminster and London. Okay, so in the year 1800, they decided to amalgamate all the laws. All the laws started coming from London directly. Okay, and that was the way it was until Ireland developed its own. It became independent in 1922. Okay, so the reason I'm saying that is an awful lot of the laws that we have in Ireland come from the English system. Okay, so it is always important when you work in the legal profession to keep an eye on what goes on in the English legal system, because it has a very direct bearing on what happens in the Irish legal system even to today. Okay, so back way yonder, the law used to be the law. Okay, so if the law said you cannot kill somebody, that was it. The law said you cannot kill somebody. Okay, so rules started changing then. The principle of equity was then developed, okay, because people started appealing to what was the King's Chancellor at the time and said, okay, well, the laws are too strict. I would like the case reviewed. And what began to develop was the principle of equity. Equity, in a word, means fairness, okay? So killing a person in cold blood versus killing a person in self-defense is not actually the same crime, okay? And if you go into the courts today, one case versus the other is going to be treated entirely differently, okay? So the principle of equity began to be developed, which was the principle of fairness, okay? So that bit, so it used to be that the law was the law, then the principle of equity kind of came in, so now you have a balance, and if you ever read a kind of court case in the newspapers, you will kind of find there are things like mitigating circumstances which kind of come in and which shorten somebody's sentence or which change the actual outcome of the case altogether. Okay? So that's the first way we get our law, common law, judges. Okay? Second way we get our law is what is known as judicial precedent. Okay? So if we have a case in front of us, on Monday morning, which is a set of facts, and exactly the same case happened a year ago, unless the judge has a particular reason for going off in a different direction, they should follow the judgment that was ruled on a year ago. Okay? In particular, if a higher court has ruled upon it. Okay? So if there's a case in the circuit court, and then a high court decision was made on a similar set of facts a year ago on appeal, then the ruling of the High Court should be what is followed. If the judge is going to go off in his or her own direction, they should very clearly justify in the judgment why they're going off in their own direction. Okay, so the reason that's important is that one case follows another. Okay, all right. Cases are a very big part of law. Okay, I'm not going to mention too many cases. Only going to be two or three cases I'm going to mention here today. But there is a wash of cases in your notes. Particularly in the laws of contract and the laws of tort, where you'll be doing your assignments, do use them. Okay. The people that use them in the exam and the people that use them in the assignments are the people who get the highest marks. Okay? Because it is the fundamental principle on what one which law is based on. So judicial precedent, following what happened before, is the second way that we get our laws. Okay? Third way we get our law is the Irish Constitution. Okay? Irish Constitution was signed in 1937. Not our first constitution. The Irish Free State had one which only lasted 15 years, because the Irish Free State only lasted 15 years, in 1922. The constitution that we use today came into effect in 1937. Okay? And the constitution guarantees certain rights. You know, there's Article 40, which guarantees personal rights. There's Article 41, which guarantees rights in relation to family. Article 42, which guarantees education. Article 43, which guarantees private property, and so on. Okay? So there's a number of different rights and principles that are enshrined in our constitution. Most importantly, in many ways, the way that we govern our country, okay? Which we'll talk about in a minute, okay? So, the Constitution was obviously of its time. It was written in 1937. Life has changed a little bit in those times. So as life changes, the Constitution can be amended, but the only way it can be amended, as we probably all know, given what's going on at the moment, is by referendum, okay? So the next referendum that's coming up is on the 25th of May, and the decision is whether to keep or to repeal the Eighth Amendment, okay, which by its nature was the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which in itself was passed by referendum back in 1983. So that is the next decision that is coming up, okay. So unlike a general election where there are constitutionary boundaries, all of the votes will be cobbled together when they're counting them on the 26th, 27th of May, probably the 26th of May, when they're counting all the votes. If one vote is the difference between the yes side versus the no side, the Eighth Amendment will be repealed. If, however, that one vote goes on the other side, the Eighth Amendment will be kept for the foreseeable future. Okay? Okay? So it comes down to one individual vote, okay? That's the only way you can change the Constitution. Okay? Can't change it by acts of the Oireachtas. President can't change it. Nobody else can change it. Supreme Court can't change it. It's only done by referendum. Okay? Fourth way in which we get our laws is statutory legislation, okay? So that's the men and women in the Dáil and the Seanad, okay? So the way it works in terms of statutory legislation is a minister presents a bill to the House and says, okay, I'm going to, for example, I'm the Minister for Transport, I'm going to lower the speed limit across the country by 5 kilometres an hour, and they put a bill in front of it. The bill is then discussed by everybody in the Dáil, normally torn to shreds by the opposition parties. Second stage is that's the second stage. Third stage is it goes to committee. Okay, so there is a transport committee, there's a finance committee, there's various committees that take place throughout the Dáil. There's representatives on the committee of various parties, so it's not based just purely on government parties. It's discussed, it's amended, it's drafted, okay, and then it's put in front of the members of the Dáil again. For an actual reading of the bill saying this is the actual way that we're going to do it. So it starts off with a bit of kind of an idea, if you like, and the actual structure of the idea is put in front of the Dáil again, and they vote on it, okay? And usually, depending on the way the Dáil is sorted out in terms of votes, usually it passes, okay? A little bit more complex at the moment because we actually have a minority government. But if you had a majority government, which you did have in the last Dáil, normally you would expect bills to pass unless they're particularly kind of confrontational. You may have backbenchers who kind of revolt against the government. Okay? Then if it's passed, it then goes to the Seanad. If it passes the Seanad, it then goes to the President for signing. Okay? President can do two things. President can sign it, or they can potentially... Well, they can do three things, actually. They can sign it, or they can refer the matter to what is known as the Council of State, which is all the former living Taoiseach, former living presidents, and a number of various other people from the judiciary who will sit around a table and discuss it. And they may potentially refer to the Supreme Court to decide whether it's constitutional or not. If it's not constitutional, but we still want to go ahead with it, we need a referendum to change it. Okay. And the final way we get our law is EU law. Okay. So in 1973, we joined what was then the EEC. Various other treaties have been passed since. All of those have to go through referendum in 1986, 1992, the early 2000s. There were a number of referendums the late 2000s as well, around 2009 or so, there was the second Lisbon Treaty. So all of those had to go through referendum because they were all ultimately changes that were imposed upon the country if we chose to accept. So EU law is the last way in which we get our laws. Okay? And that is basically the way we're structured legally. Okay? So I'll just talk to you quickly about how the legal profession works. So I mentioned earlier on about that I'm not a solicitor, I'm not a barrister, but there are obviously hundreds of solicitors and barristers out there, all making a living. So the distinction between the two basically is solicitors deal with the public. So if you have a legal query or you have a legal problem, okay, say you've been fired from your job and you don't think it's just, you've been involved in a car accident, you've run into some sort of a kind of legal problem on maybe the criminal side, it's a solicitor you will go and talk to, okay? Solicitors deal with the public, okay? Barristers, on the other hand, deal with the judges. Okay, so if you know, not every legal dispute has to go to court. An awful lot of them get solved outside of court. But if they do need to go to court, it's a barrister who will act as the liaison officer between the judge and the solicitor. So the solicitor works with you, the member of the public. The barrister works with the solicitor and deals with the judge themselves. Okay, so that's the way the legal profession works. Okay. And then there's two more law officers that work on behalf of the country. There is the Attorney General. Okay, so the Attorney General sits at the cabinet table and is there to advise the government. So if the government want to say, I don't know, reduce the speed limit by 5 kilometres an hour, if they want to introduce water charges, that type of stuff, they will be able to give the government guidance on the legal position as to whether or not you can or you cannot do that. They might say, by the way, there's a line in the Constitution that says you can't do that. As a line of the Constitution says, he may not be able to do that. So they will advise the government, okay? They sit at the cabinet table, and they're a fully fledged member of the cabinet, okay? And then there's also the Director of Public Prosecutions, okay? So if for argument's sake, you're unfortunate enough to be the victim of a murder, you're not going to be in a position to take a case against the person who killed you because you're not going to be alive to do it. The DPP does it on your behalf, okay? And there's certain very serious cases, even if you decide, if you go to the guards and then you kind of come back a few weeks later and say, actually, I've changed my mind, I don't really want to do it, the process will already have started and you won't be in a position to actually call the case back, okay? So the DPP takes over, says, okay, this person here has committed a serious crime, we are going to take, on behalf of the country, we are going to take a case against that person, okay? So they're two officers of the government, okay? All right, and then you have the judges, okay? So the legal system is divided into a number of different ways. You have criminal law and you also have civil law. So civil law, a lot of which we're going to be covering off throughout this course, things like contracts, torts, commercial law, employment law, there's no actual criminality involved in it. They're disputes, okay? One party versus another. I think the contract says this, I think the contract says that. So we need, somebody's needed to rule upon it, okay? Civil law, so you have contract, you have tort, you have commercial law, you have employment law, these are all examples of civil law, okay? So you go to court, but nobody's going to jail, okay? They may lose some money, probably lose a lot of money along the way, but these are civil cases, not criminal cases, okay? The difference, there's a number of differences. One of the differences is when you're doing a civil case, you have a plaintiff and you have a defendant, okay? One side versus the other. Plaintiff is always on the left in terms of the case, when it's Daly versus Smith. Daly is the plaintiff, Smith is the defendant. That's always the way the cases are actually named. You come across these as you're going along. So on the civil case, you have a plaintiff, you have a defendant. As I said a moment ago, when you have a criminal case, it's the DPP versus Daly. Daly is the defendant, and then DPP on behalf of the state is the prosecutor. Okay. In civil law, the burden of proof is fairly 50-50. Okay. The judge or the jury, in some cases, will make an ultimate decision as to who's right and who's wrong. In criminal cases, the burden of proof is very, very much weighted in favour of the defendant. Okay, it has to be beyond reasonable doubt, which you will have seen. If you watch any TV shows, in terms of fictitious cases, you will see it. If you watch the news, in terms of the two most famous cases that we've probably had in the last 12 months, has been the Belfast rape trial of the rugby players, and then also the Jobstown 7 case last summer. In terms of the water protests, so the burden was on both cases the defendants were acquitted. The burden of proof would be very much shifted towards it had to be an absolute slam dunk in terms of convicting either side before there would be a conviction on either case. Okay, so burden of proof 50-50 in a civil case, very much weighted in favour of the defendant for a criminal case. Okay, and then obviously in terms of what the actual outcome is. It varies depending. If it's a civil case, what's going to happen when the case is over is that one side is probably going to pay damages to the other. One side might be an injunction against one side to stop them from building the building that they want to build, stopping them from doing something. There may be the opposite, which is specific performance. Okay, so when you do a contract, it might be, I have a contract with you to paint my house. I'm not going to paint your house. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, you're not. The judge might say, well, yes, you are going to paint the person's house. Okay, so that's an example of specific performance. Or there's a rescission of the contract. Okay, so I have a contract to sell you my house. The judge might say, okay, well, I've looked at all the evidence of the case. I've decided you don't have to sell your house. So there's a rescission of the actual contract. In law, obviously, it's obviously a bit more straightforward. What's going to happen if you're found guilty? You may be imprisoned, you may be fined, you may be sentenced to community service, or the least of those four is binding of the peace. You may have to behave yourself for the next number of months. Okay. So just quickly, in terms of the system, of course, because I know time is against us. So in terms of the order of courts, we have the district court. Okay. There's 23 different district courts around the country, and there's 60 judges that served on them. You then move on to the circuit court. There's 8 different circuit courts around the land, and there are 37 judges. Okay, district courts deal with disputes up to 15,000. Circuit courts deal with disputes worth 75,000. Then you move on to the high court. I was kind of surprised to find this out, but there's actually 35 high court judges. Okay, so 35 high court judges. Okay. There's no limit to what the High Court can deal with, okay, but there's no upper limit, there's obviously a lower limit. Lower limit would be 75, okay? So the High Court is not going to waste time on, did you steal a chocolate bar, or do I owe you for that chocolate bar? They're not going to be discussing those type of cases. They have to be of a certain value. And then finally, move on to the Supreme Court, okay? The Supreme Court is basically questions of law, okay? The High Court is the highest court you can go to in terms of the actual facts of the case. You can only really go to the Supreme Court if you're appealing on something to do with law, okay? And then you also have, just kind of sitting in the background, you have the European Court of Justice. Okay, so similar to the Supreme Court, it has to be on a question of law that you would bring a case to Europe, and it has to be a case on EU law. Okay, so if you kind of say, if you were stopped from going into France or something, and you can take a case through the Irish system, and you get to the top, and you're still not happy with the outcome, you can take it to Europe, because you can say, well, my freedom of movement, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, to go into France has been infringed. Okay. You're entitled to do that, okay? But it has to be on a point of EU law. You can't just kind of take it and say, well, I don't like the judgment, so I'm going to Europe. You frequently hear people say that on the steps of the court to the TV cameras, but they can only actually do it if it's breaking EU law. They can't just do it because they don't like the outcome, okay? So the second thing we're going to cover off, which is your first assignment, is contract, okay? So there's 4 things you need to form a contract, okay? You need an offer, you need acceptance, you need the consideration, and you need intention to create legal relations, okay? So there's a very famous case, which I'll cover off, so it's one of only a couple of cases we're going to do this morning, very old case. And it's a very famous case which covers all of these principles, and you will be referring to it in your assignment, okay? Because the facts of the case and the assignment are quite similar, okay? So the case is called Carlisle versus the Carbolic Smokeball Company, and it goes all the way back to 1893, okay? So I'll just read it. I have a little summary of it here. I'll just read it word for word. So what happened in this case is the defendants, so that's the Carbolic Smokeball Company, they created a medicine. And they advertised this medicine that said that anyone who got the flu after purchasing it and using it would be entitled to a reward of £100, okay, which is a lot of money back then. Okay, and to show they were serious, they put £1,000, which was a lot of money back then, put £1,000 in the bank, and that was there to meet any claims that they got. Okay, so that was to show they were serious. Promises that people make in pubs kind of every night of the year, say, I bet you this or I bet you that. They don't really mean it, okay? This has been backed up by somebody putting money in a bank account, okay? So Mrs. Carlisle read the advertisement, said, that sounds good, bought the medicine, got the flu, took a case, and what was the verdict? The advertisement was a valid offer which had been accepted, and Mrs. Carlisle was entitled to her £100, okay? So why was Mrs. Carlisle entitled to her £100? There was an offer, okay? So they advertised out to the world, they said, come buy our product. That's an offer, okay? You then have acceptance of the offer, okay? When did Mrs. Carlisle accept the offer? She accepted the offer when she bought the product and started using the product, okay? That's her accepting the offer. But also consideration. Doesn't actually call it out in the little summary there, but I read the longer version when I was in college. She paid money for it, okay? She didn't get it as a present, okay? If I give you something as a present, can you sue me on it? You can't, okay? It's a present. Okay? You can't sue me on behalf of a present. If you don't do anything, if I just say, do you want my car? Yeah, here, have my car. I can come looking for the car back tomorrow, okay? Because I just gave you the car. If I sell you the car, that's a different matter. I can't necessarily claim it back, okay? So she handed over money for the medicine. And finally, was there intention to create legal relations? Yes, there was, because they lodged £1,000 in the bank account and said, we expect to have to pay out some of these claims. put £1,000 aside, weren't doing anything with it, put it in the bank account and said, there you go, this is to prove we're serious. Court looked at all those facts and said, is there offer? Yes. Is there acceptance? Yes. Is there consideration? Yes. And is there intention to create legal relations? Yes. Therefore, there's a valid contract, and you need to buy that. That is a binding valid contract. Okay. So it's just a whistle-stop tour of contract law, but that's what we're going to be covering off in your first set of notes and your first assignment. So a lot of information there. It gets a little bit shorter in modules 2, 3, and 4. I think your longest set of notes are actually your first ones, but any questions on any of that? No? Okay. So second module we're going to go through is company law. Okay. So in company law, a couple of things you need to know. Okay. First of all, companies are set up for a reason. Okay. And they now by law have to be set up for a reason. So I mean, if we go back to the mid-90s or so, Ireland was beginning to get a bit of a bad reputation of being a country where you could kind of set up companies that wouldn't really do anything. You know, you could set up companies to kind of avoid paying tax, for instance. Okay. So we ended up with thousands and thousands of companies who basically didn't do anything, okay? You can't have a company sitting out there that does nothing, okay? You could at the time, you can't anymore, okay? So one of the there's a couple of ways the state makes sure that the company is actually doing something. First thing is the company is obliged to have a memorandum of association, and they are obliged to have articles of association as well, okay? Now that has been softened a little bit in the last 3 or 4 years, because there was a Companies Act signed in 2014, which said, okay, certain companies don't need to, but the vast majority of companies still need to have a memorandum of association, they still need to have articles of association, and contained within the memorandum of association is what is known as the objects clause, okay? So I am a company, and my focus is to sell cars, okay? If I'm setting up a company, I'm saying I'm going to sell cars, I can't suddenly decide, oh, it's a warm day outside, I think I'll start selling ice cream, okay? If I start selling ice cream, I go to the bank and I say, yeah, I need 10,000, so I'm going to go buy an ice cream van. Bank lends me the money, that's a little bit of a problem for the bank, because the bank should have checked and said, well, hang on, isn't this guy supposed to be selling cars? So they've softened the laws a little bit in the last few years, primarily to kind of help smaller companies, okay? Because I think about 70% of the state are actually, you know, work in relatively small companies. Sorry, 70% of the employees of the state work in small companies. But in general, If your articles of association and your objects clause say your job is to sell cars, you can't suddenly decide you're going to go off and sell something completely different. Okay, you can certainly change them. Okay, there's nothing to stop you changing them along the way, but you can't just suddenly decide on a whim I'm going to go off and do this. Okay, so there are certain rules that kind of keep companies in order. Okay, now one of the things that changed in the late 90s is, in addition to having rules as to what you actually do, you also have to file accounts, okay? So if you're a small company, you file a certain set of accounts. If you're a medium-sized company, you file a larger set of accounts. And if you're a large company, you file a whole shed load of accounts because you've got an entire accounting department whose job it is to create all these accounts, okay? Now, why that's of interest to you guys is, you know, you are actually obliged to do this. So it does mean that if you have a company that you're dealing with and they're failing to pay, you know, you're entitled to kind of have, you know, if you've done your research when you set up the account, you will know that the company is small, medium, large, you can then talk to the person at the other end of the phone and say, okay, I would like to get hold of your set of accounts. If they don't do that, or more importantly, if they fail to file them, that company can be closed down. Okay? And thousands of them were closed down in a kind of clear out that was done in the late 90s. Okay? So that's that's of relevance for you guys. Okay? Now, second thing that's important to know about company law is, you know, even if I'm one of only a couple of people in the company, I can't do as I please, you know, okay? If there's, you know, for instance, if I'm driving around in a company car, you know, the car is owned by the company, okay? I can't go and sell that car. If I fall behind on my credit card bills, start racking up maybe 10,000 on my credit card bill and say, ooh, hang on, well, I only live around the corner from work, maybe I could sell the car and let it clear my credit card bill. I can sell the car if it's my car, sure. But I can't sell the car belonging to the company, even if I'm the person that drives it all day long, okay? So even if I'm a director and even if I'm a senior person, you know, there's a difference between a company and the person, okay? And a key reason that is valid and important is because, you know, if the company falls into problems, the company can be sued. The company is the one that gets sued. It's not me that actually gets sued, okay? I can potentially walk away from it, okay? So, I mean, in terms of companies, The next thing that we will cover off is the winding up of a company. Okay, so there's three different ways in which a company can be wound up. Okay, there's a member's voluntary winding up order. Okay, there is a creditor's voluntary winding up, and then there's an involuntary winding up. Okay, now the best example of all three of those is if a member's voluntary winding up is done, it's normally when a company retire. It's normally when maybe the members of a company retire. Okay, so two people kind of get together and in their 20s, they decide to go into business together. They work for 40 years, they reach the age of 65, they say, okay, well, have we had enough of working? Yeah, we've had enough of working. Okay, what's the company worth? Company's worth, say, 10 million. You want to take 5 million each? 5 million each? Yeah, take 5 million each. We go our separate ways. Company is wound up. Okay? And they go off and they enjoy their 5 million. Okay? Then there's a creditor's voluntary winding up order. Okay? And the way that tends to work is if creditors are starting to get nervous and they start feeling that the directors are kind of, they're seeing the directors booking flights to Brazil and potentially saying they know that that things are getting slow in terms of payments, bills are falling behind, they're owed money and they're not getting paid on time. If they get wind and they kind of sense that maybe this company isn't going to be around for too long, they can apply for a winding up, okay? They say, okay, well, let's do it now rather than wait 6 months when there's going to be nothing left, okay? So let's call it a day now, let's take whatever there is and let's cut our losses, okay? And then finally, there's an involuntary winding up, okay? And the best examples of those that you're going to see in the notes is where there's kind of, I suppose, a major falling out. You might have two directors who are working together in partnership. One stops talking to the other after a major row. And this goes on for not a number of days or a number of weeks. It goes on indefinitely. And, there can be an application made to wind up the company based on that. Another one is if the company fails to actually do anything. So I was previously saying, if I set up a company today and somebody has a look at it in a year's time and says, hang on, there's nothing happening in this company, you can apply to wind it up then. Okay? A couple of other things we're going to cover off. We're going to cover off examinership and we're going to cover off receivership. So the way examinership works is examinership came into being in the very early 1990s. The reason that it came into being in the early 1990s is because Iraq invaded Kuwait in the early 90s. Immediately blockades were placed in Iraq. You could not do business with Iraq. And somebody here had a look and said, hang on a sec, we're doing an awful lot of business in the agriculture sector with Iraq. We're going to have an awful lot of farmers who are going to have no money if we're not able to do it. So examinership came into being, okay? And what examinership does is it allows somebody to go in and examine the affairs of a company. It allows them to have a look at what's doing. And what they do is they try to trade the company out of trouble. They have 70 days. They can apply for further extensions, which I think it elongates it to, 105 days in total. So they can apply. But basically what happens is the person tries to trade the company out of trouble. The whole idea is to try to save the jobs, save the company, okay? It's something designed to kind of trade the way out of trouble. And there have been many success stories over the years, okay? And the final thing we're going to cover off in company law is receivership, okay? So if I borrow $10,000 from somebody, they may or may not want, their preconditions in terms of what the agreement is may vary, but if they're in any way smart, they will come up with some sort of security for that $10,000, okay? So they may well write it in as a condition of the loan, says, okay, $10,000, if you default, there may be a receiver appointed. And the receiver's job is to go into the company, they have a look and say, oh, well, there's a company car is worth $10,000, there's a debt of $10,000, right, I'm going to take that company car, and I'm going to discharge the debt of the $10,000. So they sell the company car, they get their $10,000, they clear the debt of the $10,000, and they walk away. Okay, that's if they're appointed based on the actual loan. There is also a possibility to have a court-appointed receiver as well, who may order the receiver. And the difference is that when the court-appointed receiver is sent in, their job is to actually maintain the welfare of the overall company as well. Okay, they have additional responsibilities that the receiver does not have if the condition of the loan is that they go in. Any questions on any of that? what has me nervous is I have two more modules to do and 10 minutes to do them. So but anyway, the EU law section is relatively straight. Well, when you do the whistle stop tour, it's relatively straightforward. Okay, so third thing that we're going to cover off, which is in module 3, is EU law. Okay, so EU law. the history in the background is in the notes. I'm not planning on covering them off now, but the history in the background as to, you know, the various treaties and so on are covered off in the notes. But basically, the foundation of EU law is there's a number of principles that EU is based on, okay? And you've probably heard a lot of these ever since David Cameron made that slightly foolish decision of going to the British public and asking, do they want to leave the EU? And they said yes. So you've heard a lot, probably heard a lot about this, but we can recap them now. So free movement of goods is one of them, okay? So you know, if you're a business in Dublin, you want to sell your goods into Galway, there is obviously no, you know, you don't have somebody at the gates of Galway kind of saying, okay, do we want to go? It doesn't really have gates, but you don't have somebody on the border of Galway kind of saying, okay, so I'll have a tax on that and a tax on this. You might have had a number of hundreds of years ago, but obviously you can trade into Galway the same way you can trade with the company down the street, okay? There are no tariffs, fees, problems like that. Free movement of goods, okay? You can do the same if you want to trade with France, okay? France is still a member of the EU. You know, if you want to trade in France, they cannot impose, under the EU law, they cannot impose kind of extra tariffs, extra restrictions upon you. Okay? Same applies to workers, okay? Okay, we've become very multicultural in Ireland, okay? There are people from hundreds, well, not hundreds of countries, anything up to 200 countries now working here, okay? And I don't remember what membership of the EU now, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them, 30 or 40 nationalities anyway, are here perfectly freely, do not need any visas, okay? They can come and go as they please. The same way that I want to go work in Galway, I can without any restrictions. Somebody from France can come here and work without any restrictions on them. Okay, so free movement of goods, free movement of workers. There's the right of establishment. Okay, so if I'm self-employed and I decide I want to up sticks, decide the weather's a bit bad here, maybe a bit nicer in France. Maybe I'm a wedding photographer and I say, okay, I don't want to be a wedding photographer in Dublin anymore. I want to be a wedding photographer in France instead. I can set up my business there in France. No more restrictions on me than if I'm from Paris. Okay? Free movement of services. There's also free movement of capital. Okay? So these are the rights that are enshrined and have been for many, many years in the EU. Okay? So, how does the EU work? So, the EU has a commission. Okay? The Commission is the executive body of the European Union, okay, and it is run by 25 commissioners, okay, who are appointed by the various member states. Okay? The one you probably all know is Phil Hogan, okay, who is our one. Alright? Okay? And what they are is they are the executive body. They manage the treaties. They are the guardians of the treaties, they enforce them, okay? Essentially they provide strategic direction to the overall EU. Okay? So that's the Commission. You then have the Council of Ministers, okay? The Council of Ministers have one representative from ministerial level from each member state, okay? And they are the legislative body of the community, okay? So what they do is they represent their respective governments, and unlike the commissioners are there for Europe, okay? So, okay, Phil Hogan is Irish, and there'll probably be a little bit of a nod to Ireland every now and again, but his job, and the job of his fellow commissioners is to drive the EU, okay? Council of Ministers, however, their jobs will be to keep an eye on their own interests that they have for their countries. Okay, so they will be representing Ireland, France, Germany, for now the UK. Okay, then you have the European Parliament. Okay, now the European Parliament elections take place every 5 years. Okay, and similar to the national parliaments. The number of seats that you get depends on your population. Okay, so in the National Parliament, Dublin has, you know, a large number of seats because a lot of the population is based in Dublin. In the European Parliament, Germany has the largest number of seats. They have 99 of them. Okay, whereas if you're small, like Luxembourg, Malta, Cyprus, or Estonia, you only have 6 seats. Okay, the overall membership is huge. It's several hundred. Okay, Germany, Italy, France, and UK each have 72, and they're followed by Spain and Poland, who have 50 each. Ireland has 11. Okay, it's relatively small. Okay, and then finally you have the European Courts of Justice. Okay, so as I said earlier, if you're taking a court case to the European Court of Justice, it has to be based on a principle of EU law. So it has to be saying, okay, my freedom of movement has been infringed, my freedom of movement of my goods has been infringed, my right to establish myself in another EU country and conduct business in another EU country has been infringed. Okay. These are the types of cases that you can take to the European Courts of Justice. Okay, like I said earlier, you can't just come and say I'm not happy with the outcome of that particular case. Okay. So how does EU law work? So first of all, you have the primary sources of EU law. Okay, the primary sources of EU law are the treaties themselves. Okay, All right. So those are the five principles I've already called out. Those are the principles that are that is the first place. So there's five ways we conduct our legal affairs. You have to look at the your common law, your judicial precedent, your constitution, your EU law, and your statutory instruments. These are the primary sources of EU law. Okay. And then you have the changes. Okay. So obviously, similar to ourselves, the laws are not going to remain the same. Okay. So you have regulations. Okay. So regulations are decisions that are taken at EU level and they're binding upon all of us. Okay. So if, for argument's sakes, they suddenly decide, what's kind of a good example of it, but it'd be a law that'd be imposed upon all of us. Okay. So they take a decision, it's in, it comes into effect from 1st of January of XYZ date, and is binding on every single citizen in the EU. Okay. Then there's directives. Okay. Now, directives are basically, they come down from EU, but the decision is made locally as to how we actually impose them. Okay. So a good example of directives, and it's one that regularly comes up, is greenhouse gases. Okay. So the EU will say, I want a 50% reduction of greenhouse gases in each member state by the year 2025. Okay. It's up to you guys as to how you do them. Okay. No, you can penalise the motorists if you want. You can go after the farmers if you want. You can go after the factories. It's up to you. You can leave the farmers alone and just go after the factories. You can just go after the motorists. Whatever. You sort it out. Okay. But the end outcome is by 2025, I want a 50% reduction in greenhouse gases. You guys go and figure it out within your various states. Okay. And then finally, you have decisions, recommendations, and opinions. Okay. Decisions are binding. They're binding the same way the regulations are. Binding the same way the directives are, but they are binding on a smaller bunch of people. Okay, so there may be decisions that are taken against motorists, maybe decisions that are taken against farmers, or in favour of motorists or in favour of farmers, but there are decisions they're making. If you're not a motorist or you're not a farmer, it has no impact on you whatsoever. Okay, so they're on certain groups. Okay, and then finally, you have recommendations and you also have opinions. Okay, these we get quite a lot. Okay, you may have heard over the last number of years, there's a lot of pressure on Ireland to kind of saying, it'd be nice if Ireland kind of came into line with the rest of Europe in terms of, say, their corporate tax law, and then we kind of push back and say, no, 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 okay? These are recommendations. They are not at the moment, could come in future, but are not at the moment binding upon us. There are things enshrined in some of the treaties we've signed since the EU came into force, which certainly in theory protects that, but there's been a lot of recommendations and opinions expressed saying it'd be nice if Ireland went this direction, okay? So they're not binding, but they are certainly said on a regular basis. So we've 4 or 5 minutes left to go into the world of tort. Any quick questions on EU law? Oh, okay. So from a time point of view, I don't think we're going to get to finish the law of tort, but I will quickly go through the main part of it. I will say this was my favourite subject when I was studying law. So from a case law point of view, it is fantastic. There's great cases in there, usually of ultimate stupidity on behalf of the plaintiff or defendant, but there's great cases in there. So I will start with the most basic thing in tort, which is the law of negligence. Okay, so tort is where things go wrong, as I said earlier. Okay, the actual legal definition is a tort is a wrong. Something happened that should not have happened. Okay, so why do things go wrong? Things go wrong for a number of reasons. First reason is negligence. Okay, so this is the second case that I'm going to cover off. Which I think was the first case I ever did in college, is the case of Donoghue and Stevenson, which dates back all the way back to 1932. Okay? So the facts of the case are this. So do I have the facts there somewhere? Yes, there we are. Okay. So what happened way back in 1932, the plaintiff and a friend went to a cafe, and the friend, in fact it's friend is important, the friend ordered a bottle of ginger beer. Okay? Sat down, gave the bottle of ginger beer to the friend and said, there you go, there's the bottle of ginger beer I just bought you. Okay? Friend starts drinking the bottle of ginger beer, kind of says, pours a little bit out, drinks it, tastes a bit funny, doesn't feel too well, keeps drinking it, keep talking, but then pour the rest of it out, says, so that really doesn't taste good. It is important to note, as the description it says here, the ginger beer was in an opaque glass bottle, okay, so it's difficult to see in. They pour the rest of the beer out, and there is the remnants of a snail at the bottom of the bottle. Okay? Now, the reason that this case is important is because up until that point, it was only the person who bought the bottle of ginger beer that could have sued the owners of the cafe or the makers of the of the bottle of ginger beer, okay? Because it was based on the law of contract, okay? You could only sue, you know, was there the offer, the acceptance, the consideration, the intention to create legal relations we talked about earlier? Yes, there was all of that, okay? But the problem was that the person who bought it was not impacted by the fact that the sale was there at all. It was the friend who was drinking it, okay? So what was created from that case was a number of different principles that existed, most famously the neighbour principle, okay? You have a duty of care to people nearby you, okay? You can't behave in any manner in which you, regardless whether there's a contract in place or not, you have a legal duty of care to people around you, okay? If you have a legal duty of care, if the plaintiff is able to establish legal duty of care, the next thing they need to do is they need to establish a breach of that duty of care, okay? Did you do something stupid, okay? Did the defendant do something that a reasonable man would not have done, okay? If I'm up a tree with a six-pack in my hand and a chainsaw in the other, cutting branches off in the middle of Storm Ophelia, and the branches start flying around and start breaking windows in my neighbours, am I doing something a reasonable man would normally do? No, I'm not, okay? And the reverse also applies. Did the defendant omit to do something which a reasonable man would have done? Okay, so say I'm up a tree, there's no Storm Ophelia, there's no can of beer, but there is the chainsaw, I'm up a tree, I look down, my neighbour's garden is there, and there's those kind of glass houses that kind of go along the kind of ground, and they're there, and the branches are there, it'll probably be alright. I should probably put some netting up to catch the branches as they fall, rather than see them fall into the glass houses that are on the that are next door. Okay? So is there a duty of care? Okay? In terms of establishing the duty of care, there needs to be kind of what is known as the neighbour principle. You need to be relatively nearby. Okay? If damage happens 100 miles away because I'm cutting my tree, there isn't really a principle that can apply. Is there a breach of the duty of care? Did I do something that I should not have done? Or did I omit to do something that a reasonable person would have done? Third requirement is damage. There must be damage. Okay? If I'm walking home late at night and I see a car going 100 miles an hour down a street where the car should only be going 30 miles an hour, can I sue the driver of that car? No. I can potentially report them to the police and get them arrested, but I can't sue them in the law of tort. Why? Because nothing's happened to me. If they drive down the 100 miles an hour and they crash into my car, which is parked there on the street, then I can do something, okay? But there has to be damage. And the final thing is there needs to be causation. There needs to be a link between the two, okay? All of it needs to link together, okay? Otherwise, you cannot sue, all right? Okay. So, I mean, that is going to be part, it's not the entire part, but it is going to be part of your second assignment, okay? And the very last thing I'm going to cover off under the law of tort, just quickly, is what is known as occupier's liability, okay? Occupier's liability deals with what the requirement is for me as a property owner, okay? You have three types of people that may or may not come onto your property. You have visitors, you have recreational users, and you have trespassers, okay? Now, the best example, and this coincidentally came up as a case in the courts, I think last year when I was doing this lecture. So say I'm a farmer, okay, and I have a field, maybe not that close to my farm, kind of way up in the hills a bit, but it is mine. It's my field, okay. And say, I don't know, every summer I kind of, I charge people 10 euros a car. They can all come in. They can kind of picnic. I kind of provide some entertainment or something like that. It's a nice family day out. I have responsibilities to those people, okay? If somebody falls and injures themselves while they're there, I have a certain degree of responsibility to them, okay? They may well be able to sue me if they injure themselves while they're at this event, okay? Then you have recreational users, okay? So say I have a field, I'm not doing anything much of that field, I'm not having cars come in once a summer to do a big picnic, but I do know that in the summertime there are people who routinely cross my field. I have a certain duty to those people, but it is reduced from what it is for visitors, okay? The duty of care that I owe to the visitors is quite high. Duty of care to the recreational users is still there, okay? If I have holes all over my field that people can fall into, and I know that there's people going through it, I'm kind of under a duty to either, one, repair those holes, or two, put signs up all over the place warning them, or three, potentially lock it up so nobody can actually get into it, okay? So I do have duty. So the actual case that we had, I think it was around about this time last year, was that there were farmers who'd actually, their fields get muddy at wintertime, they know that people are going through it, so they actually put up wooden walkways across their fields for these people to go through, okay? But I think this particular farmer had a large number of fields, a large number of walkways, the stuff was a long way removed from their farm. Initially, the person who was injured, somebody was walking along, there was a a bit of the walkway was broken and they hurt their ankle. Initially, the decision that was made by the court was that this person was entitled to damages, but then on appeal it was overturned because it was felt that it was a little bit intrusive to expect farmers to go up every kind of week and check kind of hundreds of these things scattered among their various fields, so the decision was overturned. Okay, but anyway, the principle is I have one level of duty to visitors, I have a slightly reduced level to the recreational users, and then at the bottom are the trespassers. Okay, and these are basically people. So if you, you know, if you go up into Wicklow, you see all the fields. There are fields where there'll be signs all over the place saying you are not entitled to come in here. Okay, so the duty there is just pure, so it's very clear you're not supposed to be there, but there is a duty, however, not to intentionally injure trespassers. You cannot stick man traps up and down your field so that they're going to snap on their leg as they try to ramble through it, okay? But beyond that, you don't have an awful lot of duties. You know, if you've put signs up, you've done your best to secure the field, if they still decide to go in, they injure themselves, the duty that I owe to them is relatively low. Okay? So unfortunately, time is against us, and we've gone five minutes over. So I think I'll hold it there. Do you have any questions on any, either on the tort or any of the earlier stuff? So like I said, you know, this is complex stuff, okay? And it goes into, I've gone into a little bit of detail here, goes into a lot more detail in the notes, okay? It's complex stuff. Do give it a good go. Don't necessarily pick up the phone and panic 5 minutes after you've kind of picked up, say, I don't cover any of this. Do read through it. Read through it once. Read through it a second time. Follow your workbook. Workbook's a good guide. If you're able to answer the stuff as you're going along, you're doing fine. However, if you're struggling and you can't do one question, you can't do the next question, you can't do the next one, you may want to reach out, okay? I have kids at home and so on, so there's an awful lot of kind of putting people to bed and things like that in the evening time. So best thing is if you want to chat, either drop me a mail or send me a text. I will certainly get back to you within 24 hours. And I will, if at all possible, I'll get back to you that evening. Okay. Other than that, thanks very much.